your brains any day. What was that?
That, my thieving fiend, is the result of brains.
Use your brain. Turn off all the lights when you leave a room. If every household in BC turned off one light bulb for 4 hours a day for 1 year, it would save enough electricity to power all the homes in Mission for an entire year. This Power Smart play brought to you by BC Hydro Power Smart and CITR 101.9 FM.
We got a theory.
You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver. We know how magnets work.
That's right.
If magic is all we've ever known, then it's easy to miss what really goes on. But I've seen miracles in every way, and I see miracles every day.
Listening to All Access Pass, created by the Accessibility Collective on 101.9 CITR FM. CITR is a collectively run show that covers issues of inclusion, equity, and accessibility for people with diverse cognitive and physical abilities.
On campus and beyond.
We are broadcasting live from our studio in the AMS Student Nest on the traditional, ancestral, occupied, and unceded territory of the Musqueam people. Good afternoon, listeners, and welcome to All Access Pass. This is Kaylin, and I am joined in studio by DP, Patrizio, Sarah, and Desi. How is everybody doing today?
Nice.
Great.
Yeah, good. Excellent. All right, so for today's show, we have a jam-packed hour for you all. We have interviews with Professor Andrea Bunden and former Paralympian Ashley Goenlock. But first, we have Sarah, who is going to introduce this week's topic, which is the Paralympics. So with that, Sarah, how did the Paralympics, specifically the Winter Paralympics, get started?
Hi, Kaylin. Well, participation in sports by people with disabilities is not a new thing, but it wasn't until after World War II that the opportunity to participate became widespread and increasingly accessible. The first competition in the Olympics in which people with disabilities were able to compete was during the opening ceremony of the London 1948 Olympic Games. The competition consisted of 16 people from the armed services. This competition cemented the first Olympic presence for athletes using wheelchairs. In 1952, the International Stoke Mandeville Games were founded, and these games transformed into the Paralympic Games, which first took place in Rome, Italy in 1960. The first Paralympic Winter Games were in Sweden and have taken place every 4 years since.
So what is the Paralympic movement and how has the event grown?
Yeah, the Paralympic movement is comprised of the historical influence of participation by athletes with disabilities in the 1948 Olympic Games opening ceremony and has continued growing in support through the present. In 1980s, it was particularly eventful, with the original governing body for the Paralympic movement being founded in 1982. And this governing body was titled the International Coordination Committee of the World Sports Organizations for the Disabled, or the ICC, which was created by the International Olympic Committee. The ICC fought real hard and lobbied for the Paralympic Games to be accepted as necessary and rightful equal to the Olympic Games. Since then, the movement continues to grow.
So what is the Paralympics?
Well, the Paralympic Games are analogous to the Olympic Games, and they feature top athletes from around the world competing, with the addition of several features to allow disabled athletes to perform their sport.
So what sports are there in the Winter Olympics for the Paralympians?
Well, the sports available for the competition vary in relation to the athlete's impairment, as is named. So alpine skiing offers the most opportunity, allowing those with physical, visual, and intellectual impairments to compete. Nordic skiing, including biathlon and cross-country skiing, offer competition for both physical and visual impairments. And there's also ice sledge hockey, snowboarding, bobsleigh, and wheelchair curling. Team Canada will have representation in all Paralympic sports this year. Go team!
Excellent. So what does Team Canada look like this year?
For the 2018 Winter Paralympics, Team Canada has 55 athletes in Pyeongchang to compete, with 10 athletes from BC, 9 from Alberta, 17 from Ontario, and a total of 3 from the Maritime provinces. Also, 2 of those are from Prince Edward Island, so yeah, nice. Interestingly, only 1 athlete is from any of the territories, Yukon. The team of 55 athletes, 16 coaches, and 26 support staff will be led by chef de mission Todd Nicholson, who has medaled 3 times in para ice hockey. While 25 athletes will be going to the Paralympics for the first time, 18 members already have medals from previous Paralympics.
So how are the Paralympics framed in the media? And do they get equal coverage to the other Winter Olympic Games?
Yeah, so the Pyeongchang 2018 Paralympic Winter Games are set to take place March 9th through the 19th. And since there was such widespread media presence of the Olympic Games throughout February, we were curious to look at comparing the media presence of the Paralympic Games. The International Paralympic Committee has stated that the international medium audience for the event is set to break records. Many of the broadcasters have committed to an increase in airtime higher than ever before, and the games are expected to reach an international audience that will exceed the record 2.1 billion people that watched the Sochi 2014 Paralympics. It does appear that the media coverage of the Paralympics is continuing to increase in the amount of broadcasters, airtime, and social media presence. However, it is not particularly equal coverage to that of the Olympic Games, which are held prior to the Paralympic Games. Before we looked into the specifics, we were not even sure when the Paralympics were, if they were to be aired parallel to the Olympic Games or separately. The social media and news coverage that we witnessed prior to the Games overwhelmingly highlighted solely the Olympic Games. Perhaps we'll see an increase in coverage in the anticipation of the Paralympic Games that will begin this Friday, March 9th. The question moves to the perception of the athletes in the Paralympics, both by the media and athletes themselves. Emily Black, a disabled cyclist, writes that there is a lot of pressure for athletes not only to perform, but to provide inspiration as well. She believes that the media sells athletes as those that overcome boundless obstacles and lumps those with all different disabilities as them. People with good nature and motivation are not simply good-natured or motivated, but they are good-natured and motivated in spite of all of that. Black, however, says that her story is not inspirational, difficult at times, and deeply sad at times. I'm a flawed human living in a flawed world, one in which women are often judged by their appearance above all else. I have not overcome my disability, and I never will. This burden to be exceptional may give those with disability a sense of failure. And as we move through the Paralympics with awe and admiration, maybe it's time to look at the expectations we place on those with disability. Our assumption that those with disabilities should divulge their pain. Black ends her story with a vulnerability and reality echoed within the community, which may not be what society wants to hear from, an inspiration. I also admit to being weary of having to get up on my own daily stage and field some embarrassing, prurient, and occasionally soul-crushing questions. I'm an ordinary athlete living an ordinary life. I just happen to be doing it in a body many people might misunderstand.
Excellent. Well, thank you, Sarah. So now we're going to go into a song break. This song is by Christina Sheldon. She's a part of the Vancouver Adaptive Society, and she's performing this week at the Historic Theatre at the Cult Clutch for International Women's Day at 7:30. So here's Empty Hands by Christina Sheldon.
You make me sad. I'm sick of all the times that went bad. I know we have differences, and I know we don't always click. But I know when the time comes, you'll think you're being strong. When I'm gone, you realize. When I'm gone, you'll understand that all you'll have left is empty hands. You thought you were sure,
Welcome back to All Access Pass, and thanks for tuning in. That was Empty Hands by Christina Sheldon. Next, we will have an interview with an expert in the field of the Paralympics. So here's DP to tell us more.
So recently, Desi and I had the opportunity to sit down with Dr. Andrea Bunden. Andrea is a professor at UBC and specializes in sociology of sport and critical disability studies. A Paralympian guide herself, in 2010 and 2014, Andrea also competed in two Winter Olympic Paralympics. Hope you all enjoy this interview. So my first question is, you teach in the field of sociology of sport and critical disability studies. Why are you specifically interested in this?
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess my interest in sport, that's been part of my life. I was an athlete from a very young age and competed in many, many sports. My interest in the sociology of sport was probably something that developed in my own undergrad at the University of Calgary, when I had a few professors who really introduced me to more, I guess, critical ways of understanding sport that led me to think about my own experiences in a different light. It was in 2008 that I was first introduced to the field of disability sport, and from there to critical disability studies. And I guess I always tell the story about how it happened, of my awakening to critical disability studies, but it was meeting a local athlete named Courtney Knight, who was the same age as me, had many of the same experiences in sport. We'd been at many of the same competitions. Our careers had been very, very similar, but Courtney's visually impaired. And the more time I spent with Courtney, the more I started to understand that my experiences in sport had been quite different from hers, quite privileged, and that Courtney had had to do a lot of advocacy, self-advocacy, advocacy for other athletes, just to be involved. Uh-huh. And it was Courtney who helped me think about, I said I'd already been thinking about sport critically, but brought this new perspective. And it was really through our ongoing conversations that my interest in critical disability studies and the sociology of sport developed.
Nice. So you have competed in the 2010 and 2014 Winter Paralympics. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, well, 2010, that was Courtney's fault. I said we met in 2008. The reason we met was that she was looking for a new guide. As I mentioned, Courtney has a visual impairment. She can see a few feet in front of her. But in order for her to race at full speed, she needs someone skiing in front of her who's basically giving verbal cues about the course. So telling her when we're going to turn, telling her if there's a patch of ice, if the track's going to cut out, telling her if another skier fell in front. So she was looking for another guide. A local coach put us in touch and we started skiing together, and we were great friends, but we were also a great match on the race course. So we started training together for the 2010 Paralympics and qualified and competed in Vancouver 2010, which was... She had been to several Paralympic Games before as a track and field athlete. That was her first time as a winter athlete. But it was special for both of us because it was our first time competing, of course, in front of a home audience. After 2010, Courtney retired. She went on to finish her education. But another one of our teammates from the 2010 Games, her guide retired. So we became a new pair, and we trained together for the 2014 Paralympic Games in Sochi, which was also an incredible experience.
So while there has been an increase in media attention directed towards the Paralympics, do you think Paralympics are getting fair coverage and important recognition by the world?
That's an excellent and very interesting question. With the Paralympic Games about to start momentarily in Pyeongchang, I'm on many listservs who are currently advertising how much coverage there's going to be at Pyeongchang, how many thousands of hours of broadcast we're going to get, how this is going to be unprecedented. This was also said in Rio and London, and this is not new. Every cycle, there is more and more coverage. I guess the critical perspective I bring to that is I'm not convinced the coverage is actually reaching more people. It's in many cases still being aired on very specialist networks. So you in Canada, you will see CBC. They'll be airing a highlight reel, basically. They will have some coverage, hopefully, of the opening and closing ceremonies. And they'll have a few high-profile events. But mostly, it'll be the same highlight reel over and over. What the majority of their coverage will be online. It will be streaming, and you know, it's certainly available. I'll be watching it, but I don't think that gets most people's attention. You need to know what you're looking for to know what's available. The International Paralympic Committee has done an excellent job of building out their own broadcast team. So unlike the Olympics, the Paralympics actually has an IPC-driven broadcast team, so that if you know, if media outlets aren't able to send their own reporters, send their own crews, mm-hmm. the IPC will provide the coverage, and it can be rebroadcast in many cases. So they'll be streaming probably, I think they said, 24 channels online. But once again, I think it's reaching people who already know that they like watching Paralympic sport.
And how do you think that affects, like, the framing and our public understanding of Paralympics?
There is an increased awareness about the Paralympic Games. Even in my relatively short time in the Paralympic movement, you know, I am seeing athletes that have higher profiles, that are recognized as Canadian athletes, but I haven't... What I'm seeing is a bit of a disconnect between what's being broadcast on the Paralympics and the achievements of these athletes, and perhaps what are the issues that Canadians with disabilities are facing more broadly. Mm-hmm. There's definitely a gap in the coverage where these are seen as two very distinct things, and I don't see that conversation happening a lot in public media spaces. So that's one issue of the framing that I would personally like to see more developed, more conversations about where the Paralympic movement fits within broader conversations about disability rights, disability advocacy, and you know, the lives of Canadians with disabilities.
Okay. What roles does social media have in Paralympic coverage?
This has been a particular area of interest of mine. My PhD work was on the use of blogging. And blogging quickly turned to Facebooking and Twitter and that, by Paralympic athletes. And what we were seeing in 2010 was that a lot of Paralympic athletes who had very limited media, very limited ability to engage the media, very limited sponsorship, not much of a public profile, were very successful in using social media and blogs to bring attention to their achievements, to connect with sponsors, to stay in touch with family and friends and fans while they were on the road. So certainly there was a period of time when social media, I think, was of huge benefit to Paralympic athletes because they lacked other more mainstream forms of media access. The International Paralympic Committee was probably at the forefront of some of the... They were doing really cutting-edge work in social media as a sport organization. So from the start, they were, every new platform that came out, they were quite they learned very quickly how to use it to their advantage. So they have, as I already said, their own media team, and it's quite developed. One of the changes I've seen is that in those earlier years of Twitter, what the IPC strategy was to really try to amplify the voices of athletes. So they were looking for athletes who were using social media, and then they were retweeting and they were reblogging and reposting a lot of the athletes' content. And what I found in my research is that people liked this because it had a real authenticity. It was not as polished as what we saw on the Olympic media side, but it was also a lot less censored. It was, like I said, just felt authentic. What I'm seeing now is that as they have built that Paralympic brand, they have also become a little more professional, and that I think they've perhaps lost a bit of that authenticity, although they've certainly expanded their reach. So there have been some trade-offs there.
So this might be a big question. Put simply, what are some of the ways that ableism functions within the Paralympic world?
Probably the most, there are many examples I could give, but the most obvious one is the Paralympic classification system, which has been, everyone understands there's critiques of the Paralympic classification system, but maybe just for listeners who aren't familiar with it, is Paralympic sport is based on the premise that athletes will be grouped into competition categories where they're competing against others, and it will be their training, their athletic ability, their preparation for the event that determines who wins, not the impacts or the effects of their impairment. So you're essentially trying to put athletes into categories with similar impairments or similar impairment effects, might be more accurate, so that there can be this fair and level playing field and we can compete. However, the classification system itself is based on very medicalized notions of disability. It's certainly based on assumptions that you can classify bodies in ways that are fair and equal. And, you know, there's so much diversity in our bodies. It doesn't always work. And the process itself can be quite disabling, I would say, for many of the athletes to have to go into a room and be assessed and evaluated by medical practitioners or by physiotherapists and others, and reduced, I suppose, to the ways their impairment affects their bodily function. Many athletes have spoken out about it not being an empowering process, and it certainly reinforces, like I said, very medicalized and very ableist notions of disability, and that is problematic. Another thing that I would perhaps encourage listeners who will be watching the upcoming Paralympics to look for, there are some categories that are definitely geared towards athletes with minimal impairments or the more able of the athletes versus events who are geared towards athletes who have more severe impairments. And what we are seeing there's at least some concerns that as the popularity of the Paralympics grows, there's pressure on the Paralympic Games to drop events that don't have many participants or to focus on the events that are the most competitive, that are the most have the largest fields, have the most international appeal. However, some of those events that aren't very popular but also aren't large numbers of athletes, those are the events that are for the athletes with the most severe impairments. So there is concerns that as the program gets refined, we need to be very, very attentive as to, are we still providing opportunities for all athletes to participate? Or in this process, are we inadvertently perhaps eliminating events for those who have the fewest opportunities in sport already?
In your papers, you discuss the activism and advocacy amongst athletes with disabilities. Have you noticed any trends in athletes' activism coming to... I can't say.
Pyeongchang.
Yeah.
I have to say, I haven't seen anything perhaps particular to Pyeongchang. There have been some interesting trends, I think, in recent years that will continue through Pyeongchang. So, for example, I already spoke that, you know, one of the reasons I found Courtney's experiences so fascinating was because she had taken on this advocacy role. Mm-hmm. And I see a lot of Paralympic athletes who've had to take on advocacy roles or who have chosen to take on advocacy roles simply to be able to participate. Mm-hmm. But there are also risks to athletes who do activism and take on advocacy roles. This is both in Paralympic sport and in able-bodied sport, where athletes are concerned about making the team. They are concerned about sponsorship, and they should be. These are things that impact their ability to compete. Mm-hmm. So they can be reluctant to speak out. There can be very real repercussions for them when they do. So what I'm seeing perhaps is that there are some topics that they are a little more comfortable and a little more able to speak to, and other topics where there's just too many risks. I think one of the trends I'm interested in at the moment is looking at retired Paralympic athletes who may be actually better positioned to take on advocacy roles because they are intimately familiar with the system, but they no longer have the fears of having their funding cut, not making the team, or quite simply just being considered too difficult an athlete,
right.
Not an athlete that we want on our team.
Mm-hmm.
You are currently working on a project called Invisible Mia's Social Cultural Exploration of Women in Paralympic Sport. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah, so this came from, was probably appropriate, tomorrow's International Women's Day. Yeah. And a few years back, I was asked to write a blog post for the International Paralympic Committee's website on the topic of women in Paralympic sport, and specifically female guides, which I was a female guide. What I had noticed, and I'm sure others had as well, was that even though the numbers of female-male competitors at the Paralympics were fairly equal, in this role of guide, you typically saw males. And this is probably because when you're looking for a guide, you're looking for someone faster than yourself. The Paralympic athletes are incredibly fast. It's perhaps easier to find a male guide capable of keeping up. The females who would be fast enough are often interested in racing on their own. So they can't guide because they have their own competition schedule. So I was one of, I think, two female guides at the 2010 Paralympics and maybe one of three or four in Sochi. So that was the start for this blog post, was just talking about why there weren't more women in these roles and why there weren't more women in coaching roles. But it actually led us to look at what were the numbers, pure numbers, what were the number of female participants in the Paralympic Games. And what we found was that although the gap between male and female participation at the Olympics has been closing for some time, and in fact is now pretty close to equal, or I think Pyeongchang will be the tipping point, the gap at the Paralympics was closing for a while and then has stalled. So there are considerably more male competitors in Pyeongchang than female competitors. There are significantly more medal events for male athletes than for female athletes. So this research project is really looking at what happened. Why did it stall? And also, what are some of the policies and practices of the Paralympic movement that have either promoted increased female participation or have been part of the problem here in sort of stalling female participation. So we're comparing different sports who have very, very different policies and different approaches to promoting gender equity within their sports to see if some sports have models that might be more fruitful and that we should be encouraging.
Yeah. What are some other things that you think our listeners should be critical of or look out for when watching this year's game?
Well, I already spoke of the one looking for, you know, what sports are available to people with the most severe impairments. Following on that would be which sports are being broadcast, which events are being broadcast. So there is considerable research showing that the sports that are most likely to be broadcast will be sports in which wheelchair athletes are competing, typically men with spinal cord injuries. Those will be the high-profile sports, whereas sports for athletes, like I said, with more severe impairments, often people who have quadriplegia or severe cerebral palsy will not get the same airtime. So that's one thing I'm looking for. There's a bit of a hot topic right now around something called intentional misrepresentation. I don't want to make too much of it because I actually think it's a bit of it's gotten the media's attention because it sounds cool. There's not a lot of evidence that many athletes are intentionally misrepresenting. But what it is it's athletes who essentially misrepresent their impairment to be put in less competitive classes. So who, during the classification process, will pretend to not be able to accomplish certain tasks or perform certain tests so that they will be put in a class that is less able than they truly are. There are some, I'd say, real concerns. Not so much that this is happening, but that athletes in general need to know more about the classification system, and there needs to be more education about why it's done and why it's important to accurately represent your abilities and classification. But this has certainly been something that came up in Rio, and we expect to see a bit of again in Pyeongchang. And then the other thing will be there is the Russian doping debate has impacted Paralympic sport as well. So there is, you know, considerable evidence that the Sochi Games, that the samples collected at the Sochi Paralympic Games have been tampered with. The IPC has not finished their investigation. However, they have made the decision to allow some athletes from Russia to compete as neutrals. It's not quite the same decision that the Olympic Committee made, where we saw the Olympic athletes from Russia. This is a different sort of classification. However, the same idea applies, that individual athletes from Russia who have clean records will be permitted to compete. But what I find very interesting is that the IPC did not permit Russian athletes to compete in Rio. They have taken, like I said, a different approach here. It's far more stringent than what the Olympic Committee decided. Mm-hmm. And I find that very positive in the sense that the IPC rarely disagrees with the IOC. They tend to follow suit. And in this case, they've struck out on their own. They've made their own decisions, which I find encouraging for many reasons beyond this doping scandal. So I'll be watching to see which Russian athletes are there and what the debate is at the Games.
Well, that kind of ends off our interview. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you very much for having me here.
Serving up a lot of very insightful knowledge.
Yeah, that was really great. Is there anything that you would like our listeners to know?
If they are looking to watch the Paralympics, the IPC's online channel is the best spot to do it, and that's Paralympic Sport TV. So Google Paralympic Sport TV, and you'll be able to watch to your heart's content.
Thank you.
All right, so now we are going to head into a quick break, but stick around because when we come back, we will have an interview with former Paralympian Ashley Goenlock.
Uncle, the rumor of witchcraft is all about. I think you'd best go down and deny it yourself. The parlor's packed with people, sir. I'll sit with her.
And what shall I say to them? That my daughter and my niece I discovered dancing like heathen in the forest?
Uncle, we did dance. Let you tell them I confessed it, and I'll be whipped if I must be. But they're speaking of witchcraft.
UBC Theater and Film presents The Crucible by Pulitzer Prize winner Arthur Miller.
Join us March 15th to 31st for the last play of the season at the Frederick Wood Theater.
Theaterfilm.ubc.ca.
Sunday, Monday, Sunday, Thursday night only, Thunderbird Radio Hell.
Hey, Ben.
Hey, Jay. How's it going?
All right, I guess.
I didn't think I would bump into you in the street.
No, usually on Thursday nights, I'm listening to Thunderbird Radio Hell.
So am I.
Yeah, usually the radio has a show on at 9 p.m. to 11.
9 p.m. to 11 p.m. That's right.
It's a pretty good show.
Is that the show with the live bands?
Yeah, it sounds like there's talking between the band and the guy.
Yeah, that guy.
Interviewing bands while they're still alive.
I'll check it out.
Live from Thunderbird Radio Hell on CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver.
Welcome back to All Access Pass, and thanks to Professor Andrea Bunden for the interview. Next, we have an interview with Ashley Goenlock, so here's Patricio to tell us more.
That's right, and who's better to talk about the Paralympics but a Paralympian herself? Last Monday, Desi and me interviewed Ashley Goenlock. She is a 3-time Canadian Paralympian, a motivational speaker, and a right-to-play ambassador, and the author of the book My Opportunities Just Dress Up as Obstacles. During the interview, we talk about her experience as a Paralympian and her ventures after her Olympic career. Personally, Ashley she is very bright and positive, and it is not hard to hear how she makes a great motivational speaker.
Ashley, welcome to our show this beautiful afternoon in Vancouver.
Hi, thanks very much for having me.
It's a pleasure. So, could you tell us a little bit more about your background and how did your interest of horseback riding come about?
Yeah, so I was born with cerebral palsy, which pretty much means that my brain and the rest of my body don't communicate very well with one another. It's just full of short circuits and bad wiring. So I hated conventional physical therapy when I was younger. So my physiotherapist suggested to my parents that I try horseback riding because it does the same things that he was trying to get me to do every week, but I wouldn't know that I was doing it. And then, so I started riding a horse when I was 2 and then got bit by the horse bug. And my parents regret the decision ever since, because then I rode horses all over the world for the next 20 years.
Now, in what ways was your training different from those of able-bodied equestrians?
Right, so when I'm on a horse, my feet get strapped to the girth so that they stay in place, and then I have elastic bands around my feet to keep my feet in the stirrups because I don't have much control of what my feet and legs are doing. And then I use 2 whips to communicate with the horse. They sort of become my legs. And then I use voice commands so that my body doesn't have to do so much work. So all of the horses that I have are okay with whips, of course. Otherwise, we wouldn't be a very good partnership. And they all learn different, like, sounds that I make. They mean different things. So, yeah, the horses are just quick and smart, and it's a lot of repeating things so that there's clear understanding. Yeah, so it just takes some time and lots of patience.
That's right. Well, you have traveled all over the world, and in all the competitions that you have been part of, do you think Paralympic athletes deal with more pressure than the Olympic athletes?
I think it's hard to make that distinction because I think all of us, whether we're able-bodied or not, deal with pressure in a huge way. So it's hard to say, yeah, I have more pressure than you. I definitely have different obstacles because of my disability, but I can't say that, because of that, I have more pressure. I just have to find more ways to be adaptable and have to find more ways to sort of figure out a way through a problem instead of throwing my hands up in the air and giving up. But every athlete, no matter if you reach the Olympic level or Paralympic level, that's like your job description.
That's right.
So on that note,
have you found any common misconceptions that people have about Paralympians?
Oh, yeah, that's a very good question. I think most of the time, like when people see me, because I walk with a cane and it's very visible that I have a physical disability, so I think it's just funny when I tell people what I did, like, yeah, I'm a 3-time Paralympian and I rode horses all over the world. You just get this, like, you did? Like, how do you get on a horse? Or how does that happen? Or they just think that we're sitting on a horse and an able-bodied people is a person is leading us around, or you know, someone's holding on to my leg so that I don't fall off. It's like, no, I'm riding a horse just like everyone else, and it's just as dangerous and just as thrilling, and I'm doing exactly the same things that an able-bodied rider would do. You know, I have a sports psychologist, a masseuse, a nutritionalist, both for myself and my horse. And just, I'm jumping through the same hoops as an able-bodied athlete is doing. It's the same level of pressure and the same level of commitment that happens. It's just not like this, yay, it's good for my well-being, or, you know, and so my life is better because I ride a horse. Like, no, this was my job, and I poured my heart and soul into it.
Yes, that's the reason why we have this show. I mean, to pass the message and to educate people about everything you can do. And, well, do you think Paralympics get a fair enough coverage and recognition by the media? Or, well, you say people your experience when dealing with people, but what about the media?
I think, again, that's a question that I went to 3 Olympics. So when I went to Beijing for the first time in 2008, compared to Rio in 2016, the awareness and sort of media explosion was amazing. Like, just to see the growth and see the support that sort of, like, rumbled up behind us was, like, heartwarming. And, like, oh, my gosh, I'm leaving my sport in some ways much better than I found it. But, of course, you're always like, okay, everyone gets so hyped about the Olympics. And have you watched it? Did you watch it? Did you see? Yeah. And then you're like, oh, guys, 2 weeks later, the Paralympics are happening. And they're like, what? Huh? Just because there's way less, there is way less coverage and sort of chatter about it in sports media. And I mean, it's getting better, but there is definitely a gap.
So what was it like competing in Beijing, London, and then Rio, and getting to meet other Paralympians from across the world?
Yeah, the Paralympics are just like a crazy beast in and of themselves. They're like the greatest 2 weeks of your life, like the best concert you've ever been to, coupled with the best sporting event you've ever been to, coupled with just this idea of, like, I'm sitting in this building that's the size of, like, 3 or 4 football fields that has every type of food that I could ever want to eat, that I could come in and eat at any time I want, as much as I want, and not have to pay a thing. And you just see people of every walk of life, every shape and form and every type of disability, and you realize that you have so much more in common than is different about you, because each one of those athletes has had to, like, fight and strive and struggle to get there. So regardless of whatever country they come from, you all have this common bond of, like, ha, we did it. Even, like, as competitors, you know, you're like, I'm going to beat you. It is my intention to stand on the podium above you, but at the same time, I realize the same journey that you went through and sort of, yeah, bonds you in a way that's like, ha, come on.
Well, and I believe, Liz, that is the main mission of the Olympics. I mean, to bring people from all over the world together.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And do you keep in touch with the Paralympians you were associated with back then?
For my sport, a lot of it happened. So in Beijing in 2008, I was in Hong Kong because that's where they could house all the horses. And so most of the time, my sport was separate from sort of like the other athletes that were in track and field or swimming or something. So we spent a lot of time, like, my village in Beijing was in Hong Kong in a hotel. And so I mostly bonded with the equestrian Paralympians from around the world, just because that's who you meet mostly. And so, of course, there was a couple, like, the Canadian sailing team, and made really good friends with them, but most of my Paralympian friends are within the equestrian world.
Nice. And how was, like, you know, going to Beijing, going to London and Rio, how were accommodations for all these Paralympian athletes and for yourself?
You mean the villages themselves?
Or, yeah, just the whole, like, the Paralympic process and the event and the village. How was accessibility for the athletes?
Yeah, the Paralympic villages themselves are a sight to be seen. And I can remember in, I think it was London, and I'm pretty sure it was London in 2012, you just have this moment where you're like, you forget after two weeks, you're like, why does this person here look out of place? And you're looking at him, and you tilt your head a little bit, and you realize, like, oh, he's able-bodied, and he looks out of place here, because he's walking normally, or, like, here, you know, and so just, you start to look around, and you see, like, one able-bodied person leading around, like, 6 different blind athletes, and that becomes, like, a normal sight, and there's nothing that's, like, a curb that's going to knock people over. Just, everything's flat and really accessible, and there's ramps everywhere, and doors that open themselves, and you just realize that, like, oh, this is, like, a utopia built for wobbly people, and the doors open themselves, and they're all wide enough, and of course, there's things where you're like, oh, this broke, or that broke, but for the most part, it's just like this, like, it could be this way.
Yeah, how was Rio for you? Elise, I am just interested, as I am from Latin America, I am from Ecuador. So, do you like the culture, the people?
Yeah, Rio was amazing in the sense that we didn't really know. It was probably the one place for the Olympics that I didn't have much of an idea about. I didn't really know what I was getting myself into. And of course, you hear a lot of stories from the media, and you're like, okay, but what is the real, true story that's going on there? So definitely Rio was full of people that were just like ecstatic and elated to see us. And in some ways, like more people came to the Paralympics than the Olympics in Rio. And people were just had like picked up this theme of the Olympic spirit almost and were like, oh, I missed the Olympics, so I definitely, definitely want to get to the Paralympics. So, you know, the people were just like always smiling and always excited and always wanting to shake your hand and, oh, thank you so much for coming, and it's so nice to meet you. So it's just like this, oh, they're all so friendly. And, yeah.
So what is life like for Ashley after completing the last few Paralympics?
Yeah, I think after my third Paralympics, I was like, okay, you know what? I've set out to do what I said that I was going to do when I was 6 years old, three times over now. And horseback riding is one of, if not the most expensive sport, and just comes to a point where you're like, I did it. I checked the box numerous times. And what are some other dreams and goals that Ashley has? So right now I work as an education assistant for a school, and I do motivational speaking, and there's just different ways where I've teamed up with like the Rick Hansen Foundation to speak a lot about accessibility and inclusion, and just I'd like to go to schools and talk to every classroom that will have me or every school that will have me and just ask young people, like, what do you want to know? What do you want to say to me that will make the sight of me or anyone like me less intimidating to you? How can I start a conversation when you're 6 years old, 10 years old, 12 years old that makes me normal to you so that in 20 years, little me's don't have to face the things that I did and they're just seen as typical and included into society in ways that weren't afforded to me when I was younger.
Hey, personally, I really admire what you're doing. I believe it's great. I saw on your official Facebook, website, all the speeches that you have been doing in front of all those high school students. Just for me, it's fantastic. And, yeah.
Yeah, thank you. It's so much fun to hear. And you just have lots of different questions, like, what's your favorite color comes up a lot, or, like, is Patrick, which is the thing that I call my cane. I give my cane a name because there's a hockey player named Patrick Kane. So it's always like, you know, the little kids want to know, like, does Patrick come off your arm or do you sleep with Patrick? And I'm like, no, he's not like permanently attached to me. Or like, how do you get dressed? I'm like, well, the same way that you do, just probably a little bit slower. And then I look something like, do you have a husband? And I'm like, oh, I'm glad to know that you're like concerned with my love life, you little 10-year-old, you know. So it's just nice to see them see me as a human, first and foremost, not a person with a disability that they have to sort of be hushed and shushed around.
Sure. Talking about your book, you know, My Opportunities Just Dress Up as Obstacles. Who and what inspired you to write,
Yeah, so my family wasn't able to come with me a lot to most of my events just because they're far away. You know, with horses, a lot of it happens in Europe, and the Olympics were never really close. You know, it was in Beijing, then it was London, then it was Rio, and my family didn't have the finances or most times the health to come and see me, so I started to write back home to family and friends, because as a Paralympian or Olympian, you realize quite quickly that you're never going to get there on your own. It's going to take a huge team of people to sort of propel you on when you're too tired and too frustrated to keep going. Someone's going to pick you up and sort of drag you along as long as they have to. And so I felt very much like, how can I bring these people with me? Like, all of these people have, like, put their blood, sweat, and tears into me being here, and now I'm here by myself. So I'd write home letters or kind of, like, journal entries explaining what I did, and I wanted it to be, like, them, they were with me, and they could feel like they could smell and see and be in the places that I was in. So it started like that. And every time I posted something on the group on Facebook, people would be like, girl, you got to write a book. Like, you're hilarious. stress and, like, the situations that you get yourself into are ridiculous. It is a lot of, like, I'm in China with a power wheelchair with my teammates who's paralyzed from the waist down, and together we're sort of one able-bodied person, but not really. And so, you know, you get yourself into these situations where it's like, what are we doing? And so it came out of that, and it was kind of like an homage to the end. I knew that the end of my career was coming, and I wanted to sort of encapsulate all of these amazing, heartbreaking, glorious experiences into one thing and say, like, thank you to everyone that picks this up and reads it, or here are some questions that I know that you have that you don't really have the guts to look at my face and ask me. So let me put it down on paper and make my story or my life clearer for you.
What has been the reception to your book?
I think my most favorite so far has been, like, people are like, oh, I can hear you in it. Like, even people who've never, are, like, just meeting me for the first time but have read my book, they're like, oh, my gosh, like, I heard your voice. It was you. Because I just wanted it to be authentic. I didn't want to, you know, spew my story to someone else who's probably a much, much better writer than I am, because I don't claim to be a writer. If anything, I'm a storyteller at best. But I wanted people to, like, see my sense of humor and see the way that I face things and sort of take in the world and know that it came from me. It just wasn't spewed out on paper and then polished up by someone else to sound and look shiny and bright on the outside, because life isn't like that. There are times when I'm angry. There are times when I'm frustrated. There are times when I don't understand, and I wanted people to see the bad and the ugly.
So actually tomorrow, or no, not tomorrow, on Thursday, but tomorrow for when our show comes out. Not tomorrow, well, weeks.
Day after tomorrow.
You, the Winter Paralympics are opening up. Will you be watching them?
As much footage as I can get my hands on, as many Instagram posts as I can follow. I'm already following the Canadian Paralympic team. I'm ready to get the updates. I'm ready to wave the
And that has been our show on the Paralympics. We hope you enjoyed our interview with Ashley. The 2018 Winter Paralympics in Pyeongchang kicks off this Friday with the opening ceremonies at 2 a.m. Pacific time.
If you are interested in joining our team or think there is an issue we should bring up on our show, please send us an email at accessibilitycollective@citr.ca.
Thank you to Paralympian Ashley Wollock. You can find out more about Ashley on her Facebook page at Paraequestrian Athlete Ashley Wollock.
And thank you to Professor Andrea Bundin for speaking to us today as well.
Thank you to our contributor Addison for her work on the Winter Paralympics piece. Remember to like us on All Access Pass Facebook page. And if you're on Twitter and Instagram, please follow us at @access_CITR.
And as always, if you missed any of our live shows or want to listen again, you can listen to our podcast shows on CITR.ca by going onto the search box and searching All Access Pass.
Thank you for listening and tune into our show next week, Wednesday at 4 p.m. Stick around for Arts Report, which is up next. Bye, everyone. Take care.
Translation? Disquarter Magazine's March issue is coming in like a lion, but it's not going out like a lamb. The issue is hitting the streets at its over 100 distribution spots, made possible by our fearless advertisers, The Rickshaw, Mint Records, Timber Concerts, Blueprint Events, The Rio Theater, The Cinematheque Theater, Massey Books, and the Alma Mater Society. If you prowl around Van, you'll be able to read up on Man Up Vancouver, its wild success and 10-year anniversary celebration, an interview with Shindig's majestic winner Mama Rudgao, how the Poetry is Bad for You reading series captures your soul, a poem submission by cherished Cree Métis writer Samantha Nock, and, of course, a full harvest of album, podcast, and book reviews and live show reviews of local bands. Translation? Forever local, forever free, always salty.
Say now, what have we here?
Meet snakes.
lizards and geckos at the Exotic Reptile Show on Saturday, March 10th and Sunday, March 11th from 11 to 4 at the Richmond Nature Park. Admission is by donation and all proceeds support the Richmond Nature Park Society's environmental education programs. Visit richmond.ca/parksprograms for more information.